Live last Monday. And this Monday, at live at Wigmore Hall, Sean Rafferty will introduce the Bennewitz Quartet, playing works by Schulhoff and Schubert, his late string quartet, Deutsch 887. That's here on BBC Radio 3, this coming Monday lunchtime at 1 o'clock.
The essay presents 5 personal accounts on the voice and radio. Shall we have a go at that then?
There now follows 10 seconds of tone at PPM 3 1/4 each leg.
The essay presents Shaping the Air.
I must from this enchanting queen break off.
5 personal accounts on the voice and radio.
A festival of free thinking.
I hope you like ginger snaps.
Oh, cheers.
Starting on Monday evening, actor Samuel West explores how radio drama gets by without images.
I once met a decorator.
Stereo line-up.
He could look at any wall he'd ever painted and tell you what story was unfolding on Radio 4 while he was painting it.
The essay presents Voice and Radio, Shaping the Air. Weekday evenings at 10:45, starting on Monday, here on BBC Radio 3.
Good, occasionally moderate.
We're broadcasting between 90 and 93 on FM. We're on DAB Digital Radio, and we're live online in high-definition sound. It's 2 o'clock, and now the early music show with Lucy Skeeping, and the second of 2 programme tributes to the late Franz Brüchen.
Hello. Last week on the early music show, Piers Adams looked back on the recorder playing years of one of the great figures of early music, Franz Brüchen, who died in August. In this, the second of our tribute programmes, I want to mark his career as a conductor, and to help me, we'll hear in this programme from a pair of celebrated performers who worked very closely with Franz Brüchen, each from one of 2 orchestras with which he was especially associated. The flautist Liza Beznosyuk from the English-based Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment, and clarinetist Erik Hoprick from the Orchestra of the 18th Century in the Netherlands. But before we hear from them, let's reflect on the man through his music making. This is Franz Brüchen conducting his beloved Rameau, the overture to Les Indes Galantes. The overture from Rameau's 1735 opera ballet Les Indes Galantes. The orchestra of the 18th century was conducted by the late Franz Brüchen. Brüchen began his musical career as one of the most outstanding and pioneering performers of the recorder. The journey from that instrument to orchestral conductor isn't typical. But in the 1980s, the time in which we see the appearance of groups such as the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment and the Orchestra of the 18th Century, the musical climate was perhaps perfect for such a transition. Here are Liza Beznosyuk and, to start, Erik Hoprick.
Well, I think, not to sound cynical, but I think that to a certain extent, the discovery of period instrument performance of the Baroque and a different vision of that music, which really, in a sense, is still the heart of the early music movement, I think that that actually, in a natural way, led to the possible exploration of Haydn, Mozart, Beethoven, et cetera, et cetera. So that then required a larger band than was normal for the Baroque period. You need more strings to balance out a larger wind section. Of course, the wind instruments were a bit louder than the Baroque instruments, so it made its mark fairly quickly. I think, actually, it's fair to say that the most important developments early on were here in Britain, particularly with the Academy of Ancient Music, and then subsequently in the 80s with London Classical Players, and then ultimately OAE. And these were very important groups and very large groups. And England's always has sort of good relationship with the recording industry, and they're quite good at promotion. And it's still true now. I mean, bands from England, I think, tend to travel around the world more than any other country. And so that worked quite efficiently and quite well here. But on the continent, there were these attempts and starts, like Orchestra of the 18th Century and La Petite Bande, who also were doing some classical music in that period.
The 80s, as you say, was a time when various musicians were sort of striking out from, well, certainly in England. We wanted to collaborate, make a group of musicians who would then invite conductors and directors, including great figures like Franz, invite them in from abroad. Just to expand our knowledge and get inspiration from these people who we'd all studied or admired for many years, particularly Franz as a wind player. He was up there as a god. The fact that he'd already started conducting, had veered a little bit away from the recorder, meant that we had something to offer him.
A recorder player standing in front of an orchestra without a baton and with minimal conducting technique, really actually just his firm commitment to the idea and his absolute belief in how amazing this music was and how he felt that there were things in it that he had discovered and had seen and felt that he could communicate to a new group.
More music from Rameau's Les Indes Galantes, and that was the air Pour l'Adoration du Soleil. So, not having had any formal training for the job, so to speak, what was Bruggen actually like as a conductor? Lisa Besnosyuk.
It wasn't traditional conducting with a beat. I think probably his most expressive contact was through his eyes. He would just, you know what he's thinking when you look him in the eye, and he knows what you're thinking. He had very expressive big hands, so he would do gestures, but it would be more to encourage the sound out of the orchestra, out of the strings. So he'd do sort of sweeping movements and often sweeping intakes of breath. So you'd hear this sort of... So it's not traditional conducting.
His conducting technique was sometimes a little bit difficult to decipher when you're sitting in the band. But, you know, I personally played with a lot of conductors that had impeccable technique, but it didn't mean that they could express the kinds of musical things that he could express with his limited technique. What he was always trying to communicate was emotional content. What's the composer? What's the sort of dramatic situation in the music right now? Is it bliss? Is it extremely dark? Is it agitato? Or is it a transition? He always looked for that. And he, as a result, he managed to explain with very few gestures and very little information a great deal about the structure of a piece. I don't think I've ever worked with a conductor where I felt so clear about where you were in the composition at that time. You know, if it's something in the exposition, suddenly a second subject coming in a strange way, or a very, very dark moment in a development, for example.
He was a huge thinker, a huge musician, and he had an awful lot to say that maybe he couldn't say it all on the recorder. The recorder wasn't big enough for him. He needed an orchestra, and obviously eager to explore the classical music and orchestral music, Rameau, Mozart, Beethoven, etc.
You're saying about Beethoven and so on, some of the later composers. I wonder if his years specialising in early music meant that he could, in fact, bring a particular kind of approach to this mainstream repertoire, you know, sort of perhaps a special freshness, perhaps?
Yes, definitely. With rhythm and with colour.
Part of Beethoven's Eroica Symphony. As we've heard, one of the reasons for the creation of these period instrument orchestras was to push the music philosophy of the early music movement into later repertoire. And Beethoven was a composer of special significance for Franz Bruggen. He recorded the symphonies on several occasions. Another was Mozart. Eric Hoprich especially remembers working with Bruggen on the clarinet concerto.
I was fortunate enough to have the opportunity to play the piece quite a few times with the orchestra over the years, and I think it evolved a fair amount, and I certainly feel like we kept it very much alive. It was rarely routine. The changes had to do with how scherzato the last movement should be, for example, or how dreamy the slow movement could be. I do remember one thing in particular when we were rehearsing it for the very first time. We got to the slow movement, and everybody knows that that's iconic among slow movements in the classical period, incredibly beautiful, practically romantic. And he said, let's just play it one time, this orchestral tutti. Let's just play it the way everybody plays it, and let's just get it out of our system. So everybody turned on the vibrato and really made the phrases incredibly long, and everybody started laughing because that was obviously not his vision, nor was it our vision, nor was it a way that came naturally for playing these instruments. So then we got that out of our system and then started again. And then he was quite adamant about things like the slow movement, these sort of very quasi-sentimental types of movements in the repertoire, never going too far into the sentimental arena. I can remember also the so-called air on a G string from the Bach suite. He said there is no emotion in this music. Your job actually is just to represent what Bach intended here. And he said something similar with the slow movement of the clarinet concerto. Just don't get in the way of the music. Don't try and express more than is already there and already done so brilliantly and orchestrated so wonderfully by Mozart.
the slow movement Adagio of the Clarinet Concerto by Mozart, performed there by Eric Hoprich with the Orchestra of the 18th Century, conducted by Franz Bruggen. You're listening to The Early Music Show with me, Lucy Skeeping, and today paying tribute to the late Franz Bruggen through the recollections of two performers who worked closely with him, Eric Hoprich and Liza Beznosyuk. A characteristic of Bruggen's approach to music making was a desire to experiment. It's been suggested that there was a slightly anarchic side to his nature. He was, in fact, a natural maverick.
He's always been a maverick, and he always wanted to do odd things and often illogical things. I remember, actually, there was a combined orchestra project in Royal Festival Hall with Orchestra of the 18th Century and OAE, and he asked specifically that this Mozart Notturno, where there's, in theory, a string quartet playing some of the music and then a full orchestra playing, that they reverse it. The full orchestra material should be played on the string quartet, and the small scale stuff should be played then with the orchestra.
He liked to have the back desks of the string sections playing louder than the front sections, which was quite a new thing for the English orchestras are generally quite hierarchical and everybody behaves and follows what's in front of them. Actually, there's something he once said about his own orchestra strings, which was they were like savages. I think he meant it very kindly. And I think he was trying to tell us to be a little bit more savage and wild and not quite so well behaved. Annette Isselis reminded me the other day, our viola player, she said, it's a bit like the difference between whole grain bread with all the husks and bits and refined flour.
He just absolutely wanted to keep things fresh. And there was nothing that disturbed him more than when he felt it was becoming routine and he could see string players sitting in the back in their chairs, using the backs of the chairs rather than sitting forward. And then he really would do strange, perverse things just to try and shake it up. It could be tempo. It was important for him to keep a certain amount of flux, I think, in the situation.
He'd love to give analogies. A lovely one, which he gave to me, actually, when we were recording the B minor suite for the double of the Polonaise. He wanted me to make it like a military fife. He suggested that I play it in a more outdoor marching military sort of way. So I always had the image of the Edouard Manet fife player in my head when I played that. Thank you.
Lisa Besnos-Juk with the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment and Franz Bruggen performing music from Bach's B minor suite. And Bach is another composer who figures prominently on the Bruggen repertoire list, especially some of his larger, more ambitious choral works.
Obviously, I didn't play in any of the Bach works, but as an outsider and somebody who always went to the concerts, I felt that there was just an amazing connection with this music, a spiritual connection. And I think it was very, very important for him to do these big works, the Passions and, of course, also the Mass in B minor. I talked to him a little bit about them on occasion, and he knew all of the text. He made sure that he understood all of Latin, for example, for the Mass in B minor. And he really wanted to turn every word over and just be absolutely sure he was getting the right meaning. He was, like so many people in Holland, really not a practicing religious person. But he was deeply religious. And you know, before he died, he had a brother who actually had been a Benedictine monk in a monastery in Holland. And he went and visited the monastery 3 days before he died. And he just needed to have that connection. And I think, in a sense, that reassurance of going to a sort of holy place. And he absolutely did that in the music. So as far as him having actual overview of these pieces, I think, like so many people in early music, I think he sort of left that to the composer. He didn't want to get in the way of the edifice that Bach built in these large works. And his way of doing that was just to try and get everything out of each, all the details and the spirit and the correct feeling from each movement, each part, with the expectation that that would work, that would build in the end the right thing. So he was concerned sort of with the bricks, as it were, and then putting them in place and just trusted that in the end the greater object would be achieved.
Thank you.
the opening of the St. John Passion by Bach. The Capella Amsterdam and the Orchestra of the 18th Century were conducted by Franz Bruggen. Bruggen was, without doubt, one of the major champions of the period performance movement, but he wasn't without his critics. It's sometimes said that his interpretations could be a little solid, perhaps a little grounded. Lisa Besnosiuk.
I don't ever remember playing anything too fast with Franz, because I think he thought so carefully about the music and hated things to be flippant. But then on the other hand, in the Clock Symphony, there's a third movement with a little trio for flute, which is a very simple scale, which goes up to the wrong note, as it were. And there was I trying to play it nicely for the great man. And he's told me not to play it so nicely, to make it sound rough and wrong. That's another example of not knowing what to expect from Franz and his imagination, which would often be the opposite of what you might expect.
He really was better than possibly anyone at understanding which parts of a phrase were the important ones, how to flesh the music out. And it wasn't an abstract thing for him. It was extremely clear to him how it worked and what was important and what was less important. And it's true that as the years went by, the tempi seemed to get slower. I don't think he's the first person for this to happen to, the first conductor for this to happen to. I think that it's a natural evolution, because on repetition and getting to know the great works over and over, having the opportunity to play them many times, they do see and feel so much more in the music, and they can't tolerate things just going by in a flash, as it were. It was very important for him to get every little nuance out of what was going on in the music, and he couldn't stand superficiality in that way. Even if it was maybe something slightly joyful, he still wanted to savor that feeling, and as a result, things did slow down, there's no question, toward the end.
Thank you. final two movements of Haydn's Symphony No. 46, performed by the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment and Franz Bruggen. So what are the memories that my guests this week on the Early Music Show take away with them of their years spent working with Bruggen?
I think the things that everybody probably will remember the most are the moments in concerts when he would do something unexpected, change some tempo, or suddenly start lifting his hand that he wanted a crescendo and wanted this intensity in the music that we hadn't really thought about before, or else the opposite, or take time somewhere where he hadn't taken time before. And these were the things that we all lived for, because so often they were so special and so unique. And afterwards, you'd leave the stage feeling like you'd done something good for the universe.
I and many, many of us were very fond of him. He was a very kind and generous man and musician. I mentioned about him encouraging the back desks. He would often, when he got a bouquet at the end of a concert, go straight to the last second violinist and give it to them. Normally it goes to a leader or a principal or something. So that was a nice touch, and it was part of his demonstration of wanting everybody to give all the time.
Lisa Beznosyuk. Well, we began with Rameau, and it's perhaps most appropriate that we end with him. One of the last concerts that Bruggen gave was of Les Boreades, conducted from his wheelchair. Rameau was a composer Bruggen returned to throughout his conducting career. And we'll hear him now conducting part of the suite of dances from the opera. I leave you with that and with some last thoughts on the subject from Eric and Lisa.
Because he was a wind player to start with, and there's something about French music and the flute, any flute, that's very connected. It's very idiomatic for the flute. Plus, it's just fantastic repertoire for the orchestra. I mean, at a time when not many people had performed Rameau widely, I think his recordings with his orchestra of Rameau bring out all the fresh colours.
Maybe on some bizarre level, and probably not something he would even have been aware of, he felt that he and Rameau were brothers in a sense, that they both came to music relatively late in life. They both had something very unusual and very original to say with what they were doing. And Rameau, I love all of his music, and of course his great strength are his operas, and that's something we didn't really have to get a chance to do much. We tended just to do these suites of dances. But still, there was a vocal element, especially in the wind playing in these pieces, and I think that he related very strongly to that. Things like the bassoons playing very high, and of course a lot of interesting stuff for flutes and oboes, and occasionally, luckily for me, clarinets. I think that was a new voice. It was a experimental, unique, strange. These are the things that he really liked.
Thank you.
Three movements from the suite Les Boréades by Jean-Philippe Rameau. The orchestra of the 18th century was conducted by Franz Broecken. Today's early music show was presented by Lucy Skeeping and produced in Salford by Chris Wines. Das Agnus Dei from the Geistliche Gesänge by Max Reger, sung there by Voces 8.
Coming up in an hour's time on BBC Radio 3, our weekly celebration of singing together in the choir. We'll be hearing highlights from the category finals of the Choir of the Year competition. I'm also joined by a special guest, the jazz saxophonist and composer John Sermon, to pick some of his favourite choral works. And my choral classic at 5 o'clock is Finzi's Lo, the Full Final Sacrifice. Join me, Sarah Moore Peach, for the choir at 4 o'clock.
BBC Radio 3 has just gone 3 o'clock. Time now for choral evensong, which was first broadcast live last Wednesday from Clare College, Cambridge. Much of the music this afternoon has been composed by members of the college, past and present. The canticles were composed by William Dennis Brown, who was at Clare from 1907 and who became organ scholar in 1910. And the anthem, The Fear of the Lord, by Herbert Howells, was commissioned and premiered by the choir of Clare College in 1976. The service opens now with an introit written by an American composer, Nico Muhly, commissioned by Graham Ross and the choir in 2014. It uses George Herbert's poem entitled Antiphon, Let All the World in Every Corner Sing.